Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
And you can all hear me, is that right?
Yes.
Good. We're halfway there. And I hope you're all okay today. I have been thinking about Tracy's wonderful talk last night. It made me think of many things. There was so much in it. And I remembered so many times looking up at the sky at night when I was deep in the mountains. And so many stars, you know, there's a lot of stars there. We don't know that anymore. There's a lot of stars and the sky is deep, deep black. And just like she said, and deeper black because of the stars. And yes, vast, 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 which you immediately feel. And nowadays, at Muir Beach, it often happens that Kathy says, come and see, come and see, which she often says to me. And I'm, you know, in my cloud of this or that, and I do not want to be, you know, disturbed, but I go out there and I see the planets, which are so bright and so quiet, but there aren't that many stars, and the sky is not so black and not so deep. And then it reminded me of one of the best teachings that I ever heard from our old teacher, who was so good at helping us to appreciate the Dharma. And I remember him speaking about the background and the foreground, which Tracy also mentioned last night. In Zazen practice, we are developing the deep background of our minds, the big self, the Buddha nature, the suchness, the darkness, the vastness. And maybe nothing much changes in the foreground, but when the background changes, there is a different foreground, even if it remains the same. It's just like a painting in the gallery, and she's been talking to us so much about paintings and drawings. Just like a painting in a gallery, the same painting appears different, depending on the color of the wall behind it. And it's like that with us. We are the same and we are different as we go on in practice because the background of our life, little by little, is changing, deepening, darkening. Also, I really got the urge when I was listening to Tracy's talk to learn how to draw.
Yes.
I want to take a drawing lessons. Kathy actually is taking drawing lessons from our granddaughter, Luna. They get on the computer and she teaches Kathy how to draw manga. So this morning, we're talking about the last of the six practices, four faiths, five practices, the last of the five practices, four faiths, five practices, and the last practice kind of seems like six, because the last practice, as we said, is two practices, shamatha, cessation, and vipassana, insight. And even though they're one practice, they're two practices discussed in two separate sections. And before he goes into the two discussions, Ashwagosa says, they should be practiced step by step, but not separate from one another, for only then will both be perfected. Which seems a little hard to appreciate. What does he mean exactly? And that reminds me of something that I've often noticed over the years, and you probably heard me say this before, the strange phenomenon that there's always a gap in spiritual practice and spiritual teachings. And I think there's a similar gap in life in general, between what you write or say and what is actually the case. Now, I grant that it might just be me, but in my experience, what actually happens on the cushion, what really happens, and what happens in life in general, is a little messy and circuitous and indistinct and hard to describe. But when you're writing or trying to explain something, you have to make sense of it, you have to make it clear. So you say, point two will follow after point one, and then point three will follow after point two. And that's what Ashwagosa always says, every spiritual tradition, you know, has that. And sometimes when you read that stuff and you read it dutifully, you actually will experience it that way, because your mind will shape your experience to be that way, especially if it's Buddhism. And it's the Buddha who's telling you that way. So you say, well, that must really be what it's like. If it says it in the book, that must be it. And then, sure enough, it is just like it says in the book. But the next time it might not be like that, or for somebody else it might not be like that. Anyway, how much sense does it make to say that you should do two different things, which are different things, but do them at the same time? And yet, in actual practice, we do that, which means that there can't be two separate practices called shamatha and vipassana, even though we have to say that. So the basic technique of Zazen, I think I said this the other day, is more or less shamatha vipassana at the same time, using the breath or something else to calm and stabilize the mind, but also at the same time, not closing down the focus of the mind, keeping the mind open to objects that come and go until you can see or hear or become truly aware of the object. And then with a deeply quiet mind, you sort of like disappear into the object, or the object disappears into you, at which point there is an alive awareness of a kind of oneness or a fullness. And this is what Ashwagosa describes. He calls it the samadhi of suchness, which then becomes what he calls the samadhi of oneness. And this is what he says as he's talking about shamatha. Then he says, and we know this from our own experience, if there's too much shamatha, if the mind becomes really, really stable and there's not much thinking, at first, this can be really wonderful and peaceful, but then it becomes dull and the mind starts to sink. And that's when you start like drifting off, maybe getting sleepy. Or maybe if you have a lively mind, you're thinking to yourself, okay, now what? Then maybe you start thinking about stuff because you're bored. Or maybe you start thinking about stuff because actually that little bit of quiet was a little creepy. Get me out of here. I don't like this. You can't stand it. So then you go on thinking more and more stuff, or maybe you don't do that. Maybe you're okay with the dull mind and you just stay dull for a while. And that's why you have to practice shamatha vipassana. That's why you have to practice investigation. So then you rouse your mind up, and then you can do that by, you know, asking yourself, you know, in all sincerity, what is this? What is it? Who is this? Who am I? And you can ask those questions without any words, just by having the feeling of your sitting be that sense of investigation and questioning. And you're sitting there waiting, waiting, like you're at the top of a 1,000-foot cliff, waiting. But you're waiting for nothing. You're not waiting for something, because you're not expecting some answer or something's going to happen. You're just waiting at the top of that cliff forever for nothing. And then, of course, something else will usually happen. And then you can see various things, and you can enjoy the feeling of being alive, which is changing all the time in a timeless way. When we read Dogen, we often notice Dogen saying, investigate this, when he's talking about something. He says, investigate this. So we can do that. We can use a Zen story or some phrase to investigate this. We can investigate. This very mind is Buddha. Or we can investigate. No mind, no Buddha. Focus our calm and settled mind on that with some energy. So now, I already told you most of what Ashwagosa says about shamatha the other day. He says, sit in a quiet place and concentrate the mind by letting all thoughts go. And rather than recommending practicing with the breath, as I usually recommend, he tells us, and I said this the other day, he says, what you should do is return the mind over and over again to what he calls correct thought. And what he means by correct thought is the thought that everything is mind, and that in fact there is no external world. Return the mind over and over to that. And I'm sure he doesn't mean like think that over. He doesn't mean that. He means return the mind to that sense. And if that seems a little hard to grasp, you could practice that, for instance, by emphasizing that everything, and I mean everything, is right here in your belly. It's right here in your breath, in your belly. It's coming in through the mudra, everything. The ocean sound, that beeping sound that we think is over there, it's not over there. It's right over here. The breath, the ocean, the room and everybody in it, the planets, the cosmos, the dark sky, right here in the belly. Pull all of it into your belly and sit with it all right there in your belly. So that's one way you could use to practice correct thought. Or you could practice, like I said, what is it? Who is it? That would amount to the same thing. And he says, continue to practice like this, not only in sitting, but all the time. Carry it with you that way all the time. In the samadhi of oneness, everything is one movement, one bright flow without any lumps in it. And maybe you will remember the passage that I quoted at length the first day that I'm not going to quote again about all the makyo, all the demons and weird things that appear, and also the wonderful things, teachings and Buddhas that will appear to distract you if you're not careful. Then he says, there are 10 advantages to practicing shamatha. Here are the 10 advantages. First, you will always be protected by the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas in the 10 directions. You'll feel safe. No matter where you are, no matter what's going on, you'll feel safe. Second, you will not be frightened by Mara and all Mara's minions. So when bad stuff comes, you're not scared. Third, you will not be deluded or confused by the 95 kinds of heretics and wicked spirits. In other words, as we can observe, There are plenty of twisted ways to develop spiritual power. You will be able to avoid them all. Fourth, you will never be cynical about the teachings, and because of this, you will be able to reduce the various hindrances that will appear in your mind. Less of them will be there. Fifth, you will no longer have doubts about or wrong views about enlightenment. Sixth, your faith in the Buddha will grow. Seventh, you will be free from sorrow and remorse in the midst of samsara and will be full of vigor, and you will be undaunted. That's great, right? And this is one that we've been really emphasizing over like many years now, ever since we have been noticing what a huge catastrophe of turmoil there is in this world. And, you know, I think we're feeling better. Not that things have gotten any better, but we're feeling better. But in the beginning of this period of turmoil, we were really emphasizing this. How is it that in our practice, you really can look samsara straight in the eye and yet remain undaunted? Which is important, because then you can be a source of strength for others. Eighth, you will have a gentle heart, and forsaking arrogance will not be vexed by others. Ninth, you will decrease your attachment, even if you don't develop shamatha that much. And tenth, if you do develop shamatha fully, you will not be startled by any sound. Which seems like so anticlimactic, you know, after all these unbelievable things. You know, you will not be startled. I mean, that's the ultimate one, right? You will not be startled by any sound. But, and I've noticed that is literally true. You know, you're sitting there in total silence and there's an explosion happens right next to you and you it's fine. You know, you don't notice it that much. I mean, you notice it, but it doesn't startle you. You notice it completely. It just doesn't startle you. I see that that actually happens. However, if you think about it, maybe this is more important than it seems. Because what if it's not just a sound that it applies to? What if you're never startled by any disturbance whatsoever? That would be something, right? Even though you're surprised that the next moment is here all the time, you're never startled by any disturbance that should appear. And when you think about it, you know, these 10 advantages really come down to one thing and one thing only. You are grounded. You're grounded in this world, in your body, in time. And that is really the greatest thing, I think, about our practice. It is a simple practice. It's a modest practice. It's very concrete, and it is very grounded. You just go on in a simple way with the practice, no matter what, and you're always ready for the next moment, and you do not make more or less of it than you need to. Probably a lot of people, possibly most people, who are attracted to spiritual practice are pretty ungrounded, right? We can relate to this. Pretty ungrounded. Colorful individuals. Colorful practice. Running around in the world doing this and that, or running around in their mind doing this and that, with great plans and schemes and a fantastic flourish. But if they keep practicing this really stupid, dumb Suzuki Roshi Zen, Fortunately or unfortunately, they will become grounded. And in most cases, it's a good thing. Not only for them, but for everybody who comes into contact with them. And definitely, if other forms of practice are much more interesting and much more spectacular, and I recommend all of them if you think this is a little boring. I wish I was doing them. You know, what am I doing? But for better and worse, mostly better, I do think, our practice is really grounded, and you will become grounded. So that's shamatha practice. But if you only do this practice, like I said a minute ago, eventually your mind will be a sinking mind, and that's why you have to practice vipassana. Ashwagosa says that the person who practices vipassana, which Hikeda translates as clear observation, which is a pretty good translation, a person who practices vipassana should observe that all conditioned phenomena in the world are always moving and are constantly coming and going. That's what you see. That's what you observe. In the stillness, you realize that there is no stillness. Nothing can be still, and that this is, in fact, what stillness is, the clear observation of the coming and going of every moment. And we call this suffering. And you see that the past that you conventionally think actually happened is really just a hazy dream that you are dreaming now. And you begin to notice that the past is always changing because you're always changing. And that the present moment is just a flash here and gone, and you can't even really say it exists. And that the future is a cloud in the sky that rises up all of a sudden out of nowhere. This is what Ashwagosa says. You realize that the very nature of the material world, of physical reality, what characterizes it fundamentally is that it can, will be, and is even now, before our very eyes, falling apart. And that's what it is. And when you realize all of that, when you see that, you realize that all beings from the beginningless beginning, because of their ignorance, have allowed their minds to remain in samsara, and they have suffered great miseries. And they live under incalculable pressure and constraint, and that their sufferings in the future will likewise be limited, be limitless, I mean, limitless. And you realize how much all the beings are clinging to the very suffering. How hard it is to let go of the suffering, even though it's painful, how hard it is to let go of it. And you have a tremendous pity for all of us who have suffered so much all these long ages, and you know that we will continue to do so. And because you see this so clearly, you screw up your courage and you make a great vow. You vow to save all beings. And in order to do this, to see through all delusions, enter all Dharma gates, and become nothing other than the Buddha way, so as to lead all beings through the morass of suffering and into the cool beauty of awakening. And then, having taken that vow and taking it over and over again, you roll up the sleeves and you go ahead and you do that all the time, forever, until the vow is fulfilled. Astonishingly, that's what Ashvaghosa says about Vipassana, which seems, in a way, a little surprising, because I kind of thought Vipassana would be a discussion of a technical meditation matter. Kind of shamatha is kind of like that, and I thought Vipassana would be that too. So this is, yeah, in a way, it is a technical matter, because there's a technique, settling the mind and turning the mind toward objects, seeing the objects in the light of suchness. And that's when you see in them all of this, the suffering, beyond the suffering, and the beauty of the rising and falling of every moment. When you have the blessing of being able to sit in Zazen, there are so many marvelous things going on once you've got through all the dramas and all the thinking. Please don't get me wrong. The dramas and the thinking and the various insights and the troubles and resentments and the anger that come out of all those dramas and all that thinking, or whatever it is, all this color and all this flourish and panache, it's all important. It's all necessary. And you learn a lot from this stuff. And you need that to help untangle your tangles and straighten you out. And anyway, even if all that stuff was not important, it's there anyway. So you have to be with it. Practice is always a matter of what is happening. It is never a matter of what should be happening or what shouldn't be happening. I know very well that there are some people, some of them are my dear friends, whose karma dictates that they will have to do 2,000 sessions before they're able to take one clear breath. But after all the dramas and all this endless thinking, the mind settles down and comes into focus. And then you see this vast panorama of what any moment in a human body actually is. Breath in all its bright magnificence and all of its many subtle manifestations everywhere in the body. The heartbeat, the circulation. Do you know that if you took away all the bones and all the flesh and left only the blood vessels, you would see the figure of a human being perfectly, because there's blood vessels. So there's like 25,000 miles of blood vessels in the human body. It seems unbelievable, but it's true. And always moving. All the sensations. I get stuck on how soft the lips are, which is weird because the teeth, which is right next to them, are so hard. How do they get along, you know? The skeleton, these bones, you know, that frame the whole body and hold us up so beautifully, and the flesh and the muscles, so soft and at the same time so strong. And the sounds that you can hear. This week, we can hear the ocean, but there's always sounds. Rooms themselves make sounds. People make sounds in a room. And each of us When you hear those ocean waves, you know, you realize, wow, you know, this is a room full of ocean waves. Every person, such a perfect wave, rolling up out of the dark ocean of Buddha nature, moving along according to conditions, exactly as it needs to move, cresting and breaking, and then flowing back into the ocean where it came from, becoming part of another wave. And then we're walking around, passing one another, and even if we're not looking around, we see one another, the bodies and faces of the others, each one so unbelievably sincere. Everybody, whether they know it or not, whether they're embarrassed by it or not, is expressing absolutely everything about each and every one of their struggles in this life, which is the struggles of all of life. And then there's a whole bright world that we see in its wonderment, including the thoughts in the mind that come and go. And they're so beautiful that a human being can have a thought. It's an unbelievable thing. It's a beautiful thing. It floats up, floats away. It travels in the past, in the future, in the present. Unbelievable. And above all, the silence, which is the darkness, vast and all-inclusive. Well, this could be endless, but I stop saying all of that. You get the idea. To see all that appears in any moment as movement, as endless, as suffering, as suchness, and to be inspired by life moment by moment toward love and care, and to realize, of course, what could be more obvious, that there's nothing else to do but go on and on living as an offering to others in kindness and with a desire to help and to care. So in Mahayana Buddhism, we have this technique, so to speak, so-called, of meditation, and that's what it is. It's not a psychophysical technique. It's not a psychophysical meditational insight, but also it's much more than this. It's a whole way of life and a vision for the future. Earlier in the session, I recommended that we try chanting the four vows silently at the beginning of each period of Zazen, and a number of you have told me you've been doing that. And we will chant them in a moment at the end of the Dharma talk, which as we always do, and we always chant them every morning after Zazen. Many of us, first thing in the morning, chant the robe chant and put on the robe, the rakasu or the okesa. And the robe itself is those vows. And in the robe we've received in the ceremony, that you might not remember it, but you committed yourself in that ceremony to practice forever. Even after acquiring Buddhahood, will you continue this practice? Yes, I will. You said it. To practice shamatha vipassana is to see personally and for ourselves what these vows really mean and all that's behind them, and strengthens our commitment to carry them out. And speaking of that, this has been one big sowing year. A lot of sowing going on around here. Some of you may be innocent of it, but it's happening all around you secretly. Sowing, sowing, sowing. Stitch, 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 stitch. It's funny, we do not live in a Buddhist society. I mean, there's plenty of Buddhists in the society, but in general, it's not a Buddhist society. The government is explaining to us that this is not a Buddhist society. So, almost none of us, maybe one or two, but almost nobody comes to practice Zen thinking, I can't wait to sew. Nobody's coming thinking like that. Nobody's even thinking about taking any vows or anything like this. This is the last thing on anybody's mind when they come to practice. They're coming for various reasons. A lot of us probably having to do with either our suffering and how to cope with it, or maybe with our spiritual longings that we've somehow had all our lives, and we need a way to answer them that seems authentic and true to us. So we show up for whatever reason to practice, and we practice for a while, and before you know it, you have a scissors and you're cutting up this perfectly good fabric. It's really nice, into pieces, and then you're sewing them together again in this very odd way, so that you can go through a ritual that somebody else is going to give you this thing that you've made. Which will then enable you to strangely put it on top of your head every day like an idiot. So that you can chant in Japanese. And put it on. Probably not what you came for. And yet, there it is. What can I say? I apologize. So everybody's sewing. Sewing, sewing. This year is sewing, sewing. We had a Jukai ceremony about a month ago, and everybody sewed their rakusu, and as many of you know, in June, we will joyously have a priest ordination ceremony, which means that five of us have been busily sewing okeisus. You think it's hard to sew a rakusu, okeisus is really big. I mean, look at all this. You got to sew the whole thing. Right? It's a lot of sewing. And then in the fall, Shio ceremonies and four of us sewing yet another okeisa. One is not enough. They sewed another one. A lot of work, a lot of sewing. And some of us never sewed a stitch before. And we're not very good at it. But there's all this sewing going on. So I thought I would end my talks for the week quoting a last passage from Suzuki Roshi about wearing the robe. And this is from the chapter called Being Myself in Buddhist Robes. So these are Suzuki Roshi's words. You may think that we are wearing a special robe, but actually it is not so. Buddha made his robe by collecting various materials from the street, from graveyards, or from the garbage. After cleaning and purifying them, he sewed the big pieces and small pieces together in a certain way. This pattern of our Buddhist robe is designed to use big and small pieces of material. Small pieces can be used for the smaller parts and big pieces for the bigger parts. Because the materials that the Buddha used were all old, the colors of the robe are not bright and beautiful. But that doesn't mean that a brightly colored cloth could not have been used for Shakyamuni Buddha's robe. That would be a wrong understanding. Whatever color it is, it could be a Buddhist robe. And I know that Suzuki Roshi had some pretty fancy, colorful robes. He was excusing himself here for that. It is our robe only when we forget all about what color it is or what material it is made of. It may be silk or linen or cotton, but when we use it, it is not silk or cotton or linen. It is just Buddha's robe. What we call Buddha's robe is just a robe. It's just the material. When the material is just the material, it is not any particular material. It's just a part of the universe. And that's exactly the same as our Zazen practice. When you become just you, that's how the practice includes everything. When we let this material just be this material without saying mine or yours, then this material belongs to everyone. And this is the understanding with which we sew our robes. We don't make it for ourselves because we're making something greater, which is for everyone and will include everything. And the way we make the robe expresses our practice. Anyway, we always need something to wear. So we might as well wear something that expresses our real understanding and that will help people join our practice. That's why we make a robe. If we miss this point, our robes won't be our robes, and they won't be Buddha's robe. It's only Buddha's robe when we understand this point and make it and wear it in this spirit. Every one of you should live in the world with this spirit. Right now you're listening to me, but strictly speaking, you shouldn't listen to me. You should listen to yourself. You should be you. You should have your own way of life with this kind of spirit. And in that way, each one of you will be a Buddhist. When you force your way on others and think that Buddha's way is the best way, Buddhism is not Buddhism. Buddhism is not one of the many ways. And it isn't the Japanese way or the American way. It is each person's way. And the only reason that I behave like a Japanese person, doing things the Japanese way, is because I'm Japanese. I can't help it. If you really want to make an okesa or a raksu, it's Buddha's robe, but if you are imitating Buddha's robe, it's not Buddha's robe. If you really want to be a Buddha or a Buddha's disciple, naturally you will make and wear Buddha's robe. That doesn't mean propagating Buddhism. It just means that you really want to be a Buddhist, that's all. If you really want to be a Buddhist through and through, then naturally, what you will do and say will be just like what Buddha said and did. Before I said that if you really become you, you include everything. And now I'm saying that if you really want to be a Buddhist, you will naturally want to wear Buddha's robe. And this might be a little confusing. But there's no contradiction. I wear this robe because it symbolizes, in its true sense, the spirit of using material as it is and the spirit of me being myself. Because this robe symbolizes that spirit, I wear it. So when we wear these robes, there's no contradiction. Well, I suppose that realistically speaking, to someone not wearing a robe, a person wearing a robe looks like they're wearing a robe. And that makes them look like some kind of, you know, weird religious person. But here Suzuki Roshi seems to be fairly clearly saying that what the robe really is a way of becoming yourself. That's how it has seemed to me these 40 or 50 years. When you wear the robe, Buddha changes. Buddha starts looking like you. Thank you for listening to my Dharma talk and my several Dharma talks this week. And thank you for your practice. I really do think it is an awesome privilege to practice together and to witness one another's Buddha nature. It really is something. So I thank you all for that. That's almost, but not quite, the end of the Ashvaghosa text. We have one more little part to read on Wednesday when we get together for our final Dharma seminar of the practice period. And we will also read from Suzuki Roshi, and maybe all of you who come to seminar that night, whether in person or online, can think of a passage that you want to share. Maybe we'll spend some time in groups reading passages to one another and talking about them. For now, there is quite an infinite amount of time left for us to sit together so that we can end this session, whenever it ends, with a great joyful spirit. So please make the best use of this time when sitting is particularly delightful. Thank you again.